The Word of Mouth podcast is brought to you by
Dartmouth Hitchcock. Imagine nationally ranked healthcare in your community.
With convenient locations throughout northern New England.
World-class providers are closer than you think. Visit dartmouthhitchcock.org to learn more.
Dartmouth Hitchcock is here.
Word of Mouth.
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 This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. How fast are America's internet speeds compared to the rest of the world? Top 5? Top 10? Surprise! The leader of the free world lags far behind Latvia, Mongolia, Costa Rica, and dozens of others at number 33. That's according to Akamai Technology. It is annoyingly slow if you're watching something on Netflix, but slow connection speeds present a larger, looming threat, making American citizens and companies less competitive than most of the developed world. Rob Fleischman is principal engineer at Akamai and our explainer of all things tech. Rob, great to have you back on Word of Mouth.
Always great to be here, Virginia. Thanks for having me.
So it is your company that came up with these rankings, but there are similar findings by other companies. So which countries do have the fastest internet speeds?
Well, thank you for giving Akamai a little free marketing. Yes, we do have the State of the Internet report, which you can, of course, download from our homepage. But I'll try not to provide too much more free marketing for my company. But you're right. We rank low here in the U.S. And there are other companies besides ours. For example, Ookla does speednet.net, which is a wonderful test platform. You can point your browser to that at any time and test your internet speed. And they rank us around 20th in the world. But, you know, we can argue about whether we're 20th or 30th. But the reality is here we are in the U.S., a country that, you know, arguably invented the internet, you know, and invented a tremendous amount of internet technology, and we are very far from the top. You know, the FCC set a goal for us to have an average of 25 megabits per second for the average American, and 10% of the country lacks that. You know, just can't get it for any price.
That's what I want to ask about. Is it just speed or penetration? Because I know people who live up in the Northeast Kingdom or the North Country, they can't download big files.
You're absolutely right. If you look at the statistics and you specify just rural areas, about 40% of the U.S., 40% of the U.S. does not have 25 megabits per second speed, which, you know, we really sort of view as broadband, high-speed internet. And even more disappointing is that 75% of the United States. Think about this. 75% of the United States, if they want high speed, meaning what the FCC recommends, 25 megabits a second or faster, they have one choice. That's it. One choice.
So what, like Comcast or?
Well, the big providers, as you probably imagine, are Comcast, Time Warner, Charter, Verizon, AT&T. Those are the big guys.
It's so all where you are by region.
Wherever you are. So if you're in Comcast country, well, you know, you may have more than one choice, but 75% of the people have one choice. That's it. The UK, South Korea.
South Korea is number one pretty much on all the
list. South Korea is unbelievable, right?
So how fast would it be comparatively?
Well, those folks have multi-hundred megabit speed, gigabit speed, and they have it for half to a third the price, you know. So, for example, let's just take some examples here in New Hampshire. I'm not going to name the provider, but I'll just look at my bill, you know. So I'm paying for, you know, 25 megabit speed. You know, I'm an internet guy, but I'm buying the usual stuff, and I pay about $60 a month for that. So if I were overseas, I'd probably be getting 300 megabit speed for $20 a month, you know, so 10 times the speed for a third the price. Some places much better, much faster than that. Now, I'm fortunate here in New Hampshire. Can I open my wallet and buy faster speeds than 25 megabit? Absolutely. I can get 150 megabits per second for, you know, about $100 a month. And if I'm in the right area of the country, I might be able to buy 2 gigabit speed really, really fast, right? But I'm paying $300 a month for that more. So, you know, do we have super high speed internet here in the United States? Absolutely. Depends where you are.
And how much you can pay.
And how much you can pay. Absolutely. So, you know, the average person, you know, is paying, like I said, a lot more money for a lot less here in the U.S.
Okay, so let's look at why. The U.S. presents itself as a leader in technology. But, you know, the internet just doesn't float in the air. It depends on infrastructure.
Absolutely.
So what have other countries got that we don't?
Well, let's talk about the high level issues. I think that, you know, I'm a little controversial here because I don't toe the line with what everyone thinks the problem is. Everyone thinks the problem is incentives, which I wholly agree with. So we'll talk about that. But there's another issue, I think, a little deeper, a little more complex. So the first thing is incentives, right? So in 1996, we passed the Telecommunications Act, okay? And what the Telecommunications Act was, complicated as you might imagine, but it basically allowed mergers to occur and for folks to divide up regions of the country. So, you know, business being business, what happened? The large companies bought lots of small internet providers. I mean, we remember back in the days of dial-up when there were thousands of internet providers, right? I mean, I loved it because I was a vendor back then. Still am a vendor, but back then it was nice having thousands of customers. Today, we have much fewer providers of internet service than we used to years ago. And they've really become regional monopolies. You know, if you're in the Northeast, you're probably in Comcast country. If you're down in New York, you might be in Cablevision country. If you're in certain areas of the U.S., you might be in AT&T or Time Warner or Charter area. And that's, you know, there's always a dominant player. So that Telecommunications Act allowed that to happen. So when that happens, incentives disappear. You talked about South Korea before. South Korea had massive competition, even in the UK today. We still have a lot of competition. There are multiple very high-speed providers competing for each other. As we know, competition lowers the price, okay? So there really isn't a lot of competition here, and therefore there isn't incentives to be aggressive in that way. Now, you know, you're going to hear from every provider in the world how expensive it is and how they're upgrading their service. Absolutely they are. I started by telling you how the speeds have gone up in this country. But there's nothing like competition to light the fire under that, right? And to really get those prices down. Now, there has been something interesting that's happening. Google has something called Google Fiber, which is gigabit speed fiber optic access to the internet that they've been deploying in limited areas all over the country. And I don't know what Google says their motivation is, but I can tell you what I think their motivation is. Yeah. Their motivation really is to put the fire under the dominant internet provider in the region. When Google Fiber comes in, magically, the access speed to people in that area goes up and the price goes down. Magically.
Okay, so Google Fiber is an infrastructure thing.
That's right.
Is the pipe that carries the internet to
absolutely,
you, right?
Absolutely, absolutely. And that actually is a great segue into the second reason why I think our internet access in the United States is slow. And it goes exactly to what you just said, Virginia, and that is infrastructure, okay? So there are a lot of countries where, you know, they weren't the beginning builders of the internet. They didn't start with twisted pair phone lines to your house or copper cable running down your street, right? They were like, well, we have nothing. So if we're going to start, let's lay fiber optic cable. Now, I'm not saying we shouldn't upgrade. We should. But when you're a large multi-billion dollar company and you have tens of millions of customers, it's very difficult to rationalize ripping up an existing infrastructure that's been working well for many years and is profitable, to rip it all out and install hundreds of millions or billions of dollars worth of new fiber optic cable when there isn't quite the fiscal rationale to do so.
We're talking about why internet speeds in the U.S. are so much slower than so much of the developing world. And as usual, Rob Fleischman, our chief explainer of all things technological, points out that it's a little complicated. It is not such an easy answer. But what would be an incentive?
Well, competition is definitely the biggest incentive.
Right, you've
got
that.
I applaud things like Google Fiber. I also applaud a little bit of government regulation with regard to how far and wide these monopolies can grow. You know, it was almost laughable. Comcast and Time Warner had a merger proposed a number of years ago. Okay, and
I remember that.
You remember it, and the merger did not happen.
The government was afraid of forming a monopoly, wasn't
absolutely.
It?
Absolutely. One of the rationale that they came up with for why it was okay was because they said, "Hey, Comcast and Time Warner, if we merge together, it actually doesn't decrease competition. It doesn't decrease competition because we don't compete in any regions." And I laughed and said, oh, my God, you're literally saying we don't compete in any regions because they have a monopoly over here and we have a monopoly over there. So putting us together doesn't decrease competition because guess what? There's no competition. There's no, if you're at zero, you can't go below zero.
Right. They're the Ma Bell all of a sudden.
Exactly. So I thought, oh, my God, I can't believe you're using the actual problem as the rationalization why it's OK for you to go forward. So that merger didn't happen, which I was glad about. Because I look at the consumer and I say that if we are given more choices, if we are given more competitors, then obviously the quality will go up. And that's true in any business. So I think that that's going to be a huge key going forward. And I do have some hope because, as you know, a lot of us are really depending on wireless, mm-hmm. right? And wireless, as that technology goes forward, doesn't require the gigantic infrastructure investment that, you know, running fiber optic cable everywhere depends on.
The incentive for the companies has to be, you know, they need to make money. They've put this kind of investment together. But how about thinking beyond that? You know, like, what is going to happen to American companies and citizens in the global market if they have much slower internet than other people? They can't catch up.
No, you're right. I mean, that's a really serious problem. Fortunately, most of our companies, at least the large ones that are in the internet space, are not just U.S.-based, right? I mean, you look at the big guys that depend on it, the Facebooks, the Googles, they have just as many customers overseas, if not more, than they do here. So, you know, sadly, the people that are going to suffer are the small guy and the consumer here. And that's just the truth.
Is there anything that we as individual users and companies can do to improve our internet speed?
Oh, sure. Well, look, you know, one of the things that I think folks should do is they should go to a place like speedtest.net. And there are lots of other places besides that one. That just happens to be one run by Ookla and is very well known. And, you know, bring your browser there and check out what your speed is, what your actual speed is, and then compare that to what you're paying for. You know, if you're paying for 25 megabits and you're getting 10, well, there might be a problem. Now, what that problem is in your house, almost always the problem is that you're using your wireless network. Hell, you know, look at me. I was on my laptop this morning and my speed test numbers were about 10 megabits to my wireless laptop. But yet when I go to my plugged-in computer, I'm getting my full 25 megabits or more mm-hmm. from my provider. So, you know, they're not cheating me, but my own infrastructure in my house is hurting me. Now, why is that? Well, it could be that, you know, maybe I have an old Wi-Fi router. Most of us do. They probably bought it a long time ago, and then it still works, right? But it's not the fastest anymore. It's old. Also, you know, there's stuff in my house. I have microwaves. I have metal. I have all kinds of things that slows my Wi-Fi speeds. I also might have a lot of other devices using it as well, right? All my kids' phones mm-hmm. and televisions and all that stuff using it. But then the other thing is also the laws of physics, right? How far am I away from my Wi-Fi hotspot, right? The farther I am away, the slower it's going to be. So I think that if you think about your home and you say, okay, well, first let me test to make sure I'm getting what I'm paying for. And then the second thing is, well, look at my equipment. How old is it? Maybe it needs to be upgraded. And then finally, where am I using my internet from? You know, if my Wi-Fi hotspot's in the basement, I'm three levels up using Wi-Fi on my laptop, well, that's going to be a problem. Maybe you should consider moving your Wi-Fi hotspot a little closer.
But isn't that the whole point of having Wi-Fi, that we are supposed to be able to, you could be lounging out in the pool at the cabana and using your Wi-Fi. It shouldn't matter.
That's true. But, you know, people have a tendency to not buy things to make their lives better when it costs money. You know, I mean, admittingly, I have a Wi-Fi hotspot that's probably a decade old. Now, I have that one outside, and, you know, that's not the main Wi-Fi hotspot, but boy, I can tell you it's quite a bit slower using that one than it is using the wired in the house.
Well, you got us up to speed anyway, Robin. We really appreciate it.
Always wonderful being here, Virginia. Thanks for having me.
Rob Fleischman, he's principal engineer at Akamai and word of mouth explainer of all things tech. You can learn more about why America's internet speed is so slow at wordofmouthradio.org. We'll also put a link to speednet.net so you can test your own speed at home. This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. NBC's ratings may not be going through the roof, but if you have been watching or even seen clips from the Olympic Games in Rio, consider this. All that mix of athletes and fans and hurrahs and yelling bouncing off echoey stadiums are like a cacophony and the challenge for people whose jobs you probably didn't even realize existed. Sports sound designers. Host Roman Mars in the podcast 99% Invisible brings us their story.
This is 99% Invisible. I'm Roman Mars. If Dennis Baxter and Bill Whiston are doing their job right, you probably don't notice that they're doing their job. But they are so good at doing their job, you probably don't even know that their job exists at all. They are sound designers for televised sporting events. Their job is to draw the audience into the action and make sports sound as exciting as possible. And that doesn't mean that they throw a bunch of microphones on the field. This is Dennis Baxter, sound designer of the Olympics.
There's some sports that you just cannot capture the natural sound. Cross-country skiing, biathlon is another one. Because of the size of the course. And this has been further complicated because as the camera lenses have gone up 110, 120, 130, 140 to 1, these cameras are able to see a half a kilometer, maybe even a kilometer down the course. Now, how do you replicate that sound? Essentially, if you got cameras that are that far apart from each other, you're putting 20 or 30 microphones to fill as the athletes are coming to you, which is not practical. I am not a purist whatsoever in sound production. I truly believe that whatever the tool takes to deliver a high-quality, entertaining soundscape, it's all fair game. And that has caused some issues because I use samplers. What a sampler is, it's a keyboard that's attached to essentially a digital recorder. When you hit the key on the keyboard, it triggers the sound to play back, and with the keyboard it also triggers with sensitivity, meaning that if I hit the key real hard, it'll have a little bit more of a harder attack, and you can vary the pitch. If I hit a C note that has a sample, and then I hit a D note of the same sample, it will be up a step. So for the skiing, it gives a shh, shh.
Redgrave and Pinsent still hold the lead. The French in third, and we could do without seeing them at the moment.
In Atlanta, one of my biggest problems was rowing. Rowing is a 2-kilometer course. They have 4 chase boats following the rowers, and they have a helicopter. Okay, that's what they need to deliver the visual coverage of it. Okay, but the helicopter and the chase boats just completely wash out the sound. So no matter how good the microphones are, you cannot capture, you cannot reach and isolate sound like you do visually. But people have expectations. Okay, if you see the rowers, they have a sound that they're expecting. So what do we do? That afternoon, we went out on a canoe with a couple of rowers and recorded stereo samples of the different type of effects that would be somewhat typical of an event. And then we loaded those recordings into a sampler and played them back to cover the shots of the boats.
And the Australians have bitten something back from them, but not enough. Great Britain, gold medals! Stephen Redgrave, Matthew Pinson, mission accomplished.
Stand by. And they're racing. Good even dispatch, although...
When we do our horse racing, you're not going to get somebody running around the course after the horses. There's no way. And occasionally you will come across very close-up pictures of the horses over the far side, which is done off one of our roving cameras. But you have engine noise in that case, so therefore you wouldn't want a microphone on that, because all you would hear is the car revving up and the cameraman cursing. So, basically, the way you cover all that sort of stuff is to run a tape which has the sound of horses' hooves galloping, which is actually, if I remember rightly, a slowed-down buffalo charge. That's pretty much a standard thing, and I think it's probably the same recording they've used for years.
And that story came to us from host Roman Mars in the podcast 99% Invisible. This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. There is a universal belief that all we really want is to love and to be loved. How unfortunate it is that there are so many ways to get it wrong. Falling for someone when you can't understand a word they're saying. Figuring out how to deal with siblings who make you crazy. Or befriending a series of older women to fill the void left when your mother dies. The Love Me podcast puts our fumbling, messy relationships center stage.
this picture that looks weird, like there was a mistake in this family. It finally made sense. That weird little kid in the middle, that's me.
From CBC, this is Love Me, a show about the messiness of human connection. Episode 5, Family Portrait.
That was Lou Okolsky, who hosts the show. Mira Burt-Wintonik is one of the creators of the show and produces it for CBC Radio and is joining us with more. Mira, welcome to Word of Mouth.
Thanks so much.
Well, I guess you got plenty of material, but what inspired you to create Love Me?
Well, it partly came from a desire of just wanting to kind of pry into people's very personal lives, just kind of on a personal level. I'm very curious to know what's going on inside people's hearts and souls. And I kind of wanted an excuse to talk to people about, you know, their relationships and what's really going on. Because, you know, relationships are the kind of thing that they might seem one way when you're on the outside. You know, you're looking at your friends' situations or the people around you. And it's always kind of surprising to see what's really going on, you know, behind closed doors or how those people are really feeling about each other. So I wanted an excuse to just, you know, ask people some very personal questions about what is going on.
Well, this can be kind of kryptonite-like stuff for a lot of people. We're speaking to you 8 episodes in. Any trouble finding people who are willing to share these kind of intimate details of their lives?
Surprisingly not, actually. We kind of anticipated having to pry this stuff out of people, but I think people are actually really just dying for an excuse to kind of open up and have someone to spill their guts to.
And sometimes they are produced stories. This one, Episode 5, Family Portrait, produced by Hannah Kingsley Ma. It's about, in part, the worst car ride ever, this defining moment in the life of one family. So the setup is 3 daughters have a terrible fight on a road trip. Father stops the car, makes everybody get out. And afterwards, their mother makes them all write about the experience as punishment. So here's a bit from Emily, the oldest sister's letter.
To tell you the truth, the cons of being the oldest overpower the pros. Let's take a look at the charts. Pros, you get to buy new attire. You have much power / responsibility. Cons. Being the first means that you are the guinea pig. You have no one to look up to, therefore making you forge a new path for yourself. People look up to you, so you have to watch everything you say / do. This chart has proved that being the oldest is harder than it meets the eye, so in the future, it would be appreciated if you were to cut me some slack, for all of us are human beings. And that's the truth.
What was the appeal of that story for you?
I'm actually an only child personally, so I was kind of curious about the ways that, you know, sibling dynamics work, sibling rivalries, how those evolve over time. And Hannah sort of brought us that story where she wanted to look back on, you know, they have these letters that are kind of proof of like what these 3 sisters' relationship was like when they were young. And she wanted to kind of talk to them now and see how that's evolved, whether this kind of birth order, you know, oldest, middle child, youngest, is still something that affects their relationship, which, you know, it does in many ways.
I think of, you know, things happen in families. We all remember them very, very differently. You know, we carry our own impressions and narratives of them. Is this a way to sort of pull those things together?
Yeah, I think talking about these things and also hearing other people sharing these experiences is a way to kind of feel like your messed up situation isn't quite as messy, or isn't, you know, you don't have to feel as guilty about it or as alone with that kind of struggling that you're experiencing in terms of figuring out your own family dynamics. So just kind of hearing other people going through the same thing can actually help you, you know, process your own complicated relationships.
These are the kind of memories that people do keep locked up and spend their lives trying to transcend. There's an episode called Shame, which speaks to how difficult it is, I don't know, to talk these things through. Are you looking for, what, resolution here?
I don't know if you'll ever have, like, 100% resolution. I think, you know, relationships are so complex and they're always evolving. Like, every day they're a little bit different than the previous one. And, you know, it's just about, I guess, getting some kind of peace with that unpeacefulness, if that makes sense. You know, the only places we wouldn't go is something that feels kind of exploitative, where someone is being, because, you know, vulnerability can make great tape, and, you know, someone having really emotional experience can also make great tape. You know, there's a few episodes where people cry and people kind of break down in the show, but we always make sure we're walking that line where we're being respectful and treating our subjects fairly and not taking advantage of that vulnerability.
Well, we've got another clip. This harkens back to our earlier clip. A man who's just received a phone call from someone claiming to be his sister, and she's claiming that the man he believed to be his father his entire life was just a surrogate.
I have this family photo, and I think I'm about 3 years old in this picture. And there's this family with very, like, distinct features, you know, consistent hair color. And then there's this one weird little kid in the middle. Like, he wandered in from somebody else's family photo. And that finally made sense.
A lot of emotion here. Mm-hmm. Is it tough to corral this kind of story into a narrative arc that works for an episode? Do you spend a lot of time coaching people on how to tell that story?
Yeah, we'll definitely record for about an hour or so, or sometimes longer, just to get, you know, a 6-minute piece. So we'll ask people to rephrase until it, you know, sometimes I find the first 20 minutes of an interview are not that usable. People are nervous. They don't know what's expected of them. They're kind of playing a role. And you just kind of have to get past that, get through that, and then re-ask them the same questions again that you did cover already, and just get them to say it in a more comfortable way once they're kind of loosened up and they feel, you know, like there's a good dynamic between the, you know, the interviewer and the subject.
We get a lot of surprising, different kind of angles on negotiating love and relationships and the fantasy worlds we make up, searching for past loves, love triangles. Is that your goal, to kind of have something for everyone?
Yeah, I think we wanted to cover a broad range of what love is, what it means, and all the different ways it manifests itself in our lives. You know, we didn't want to just do another dating show that's just about romantic love. We wanted to get to these kind of less talked about relationships, but that are really just as important in our lives. You know, we often kind of define our love lives as our romantic partnerships, but love is so much more than just those specific relationships that we have. You know, it affects, it's in all aspects of our lives and every relationship we have with everyone. So we wanted to just kind of, yeah, explore those other corners of relationships that are less talked about.
Well, Mira, look forward to more, and thanks so much for speaking with us.
My pleasure.
Mira Burt-Wintonic, an award-winning audio producer. She's also one of the creators and producers of the CBC podcast Love Me. You can find a link to the Love Me website and the episodes at our website, wordofmouthradio.org. This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. Preparing for the Olympics is a mental and physical pursuit. Take U.S. swimmer Katie Ledecky, who broke records and collected medals in Rio last week, reflecting training both in and out of the pool. Speaking to the Washington Post, Katie's coach said that after winning gold in London, they immediately shifted focus toward the future. What's going to get you excited for 3 years and make you want to get out of bed in the morning to go and practice? He asked her. They set an outrageous goal: swim the 400-meter freestyle in 3 minutes and 56 seconds. They kept it a secret until last week, when Katie did it, beating her previous best time by nearly 2 seconds. Creating a goal is one thing. Following through is often what separates the Olympians we cheer for from the rest of us. Amanda Kroll is an educational researcher and cognitive psychologist. She wrote about 3 mindsets shared by people who follow through on their goals for quartz. Amanda, welcome to Word of Mouth.
Hi.
So many of us were inspired watching Olympic athletes and thought, okay, we could do something. But setting goals is easy. Why is it such a challenge for us mere mortals to follow through?
So I think part of the reason why people have a hard time following through on their goals is the goals that they set are too big. So someone will say, wow, that was really great watching the Olympics. Those track and field people are so fast, and I want to be just like them. So I'm going to try to run a marathon next year. And then they backwards plan. They think, well, in 6 months, I need to be able to run, you know, a half marathon. And so in 3 months, I need to be able to run like 10 miles. And so next week, I better be able to run a 5K. But that just isn't how people get better at things. And I think that when you have a coach, like the people who are in the Olympics, they will help them set really aspirational goals and then help them to break those goals down into something they can do this week.
Well, let's get to these mindsets and break it down. Say I've got a goal in mind. What is the first thing I should do to make sure I follow through?
So the first thing I would do is to take into account the growth mindset. So first of all, you should assume that it's going to be difficult. to follow through on your goals. And so when you go out there and you struggle a little, or you have a failure, or it's harder than you thought it was going to be, you need to think about that as, you know, proof that you're getting better at it, that you're getting stronger, that you're getting more effective at what you're trying to do. When you very first set a goal, you should just start saying to yourself, it's going to be harder than I think. Because then when it happens, you're not surprised and you can interpret it right, which is, you know, this is me getting stronger.
In setting out the mindsets for following through on goals, one that I really liked was learn to be kind to yourself. That's not where a lot of people begin, is it?
No, but it's really, really important. When you're kind to yourself, you allow yourself to fail. And if you won't allow yourself to fail, you're guaranteed not to follow through on your goals. Because anything that you do for the first time, you're going to do it really badly because you're learning how to do something new.
I heard a story last week about a former Olympic gymnast saying that, you know, her father was abusive.
Mm-hmm.
Does kindness motivate a person the same way that you better do this or you're a failure does?
Yes. In fact, it's actually more motivating. I mean, there's no question that being hard on somebody can make them do things. But it's not going to be the long-term solution for most people, for most of the things they're trying to do. Willpower is something that's actually really limited for most people. So if you're trying to do something by sheer force of will, you'll eventually run out of willpower and you'll go back to the way things were.
How about step two? Find a community, like-minded people. Why is that important?
Well, humans are naturally communal. So if you're deciding to take on something new, it's really helpful to have somebody else who is a little bit ahead of you, who can give you a little bit of advice, or somebody who's in the same place as you are, who you can have camaraderie with and share your little failures and it feels less like, you know, you're alone failing and more like you're part of a tribe of people who are figuring out how to do this together. But you're not going to be motivated to go hang out with a bunch of people that you don't really appreciate. So, for example, if you're not a competitive person and you go try to run with a group of really competitive runners, then you go there, first of all, you're going to have a really maybe possibly traumatizing experience because the things that motivate them, like, you know, trash talk and that kind of thing might just rub you the wrong way and make you feel like a huge, you know, outsider. That's not the point. You have to find the group of people who feels to you like it's supportive and interesting and helpful. And then it can help you get out there. It can help you improve. It can keep you motivated when you just don't feel like it.
Your third recommendation, thinking about your future self.
Mm-hmm.
Do we need to master one and two before we can get to this step?
No, definitely not.
And how specific should we be about imagining that future self?
So I think imagining a future self in the future can be aspirational. So you can dream about what it would be like to be a competitive athlete. But the major and most important piece of it is once you have that vision in place, once you have that sort of thing that gets you really excited, then you have to pull way, way back and make your goals much more shorter term. So the aspirational vision keeps you moving. It gives you the motivation to do things that are hard. But the things that you're actually asking yourself to do this week are the goals that you should be thinking about the most. You know, if you're never an Olympic athlete or a person who runs a marathon or a lawyer, it doesn't matter whether you actually become that. The purpose of vision or aspiration is to create motivation. Then how you use that motivation, you'll be much more effective if you're driving it towards short-term goals, that you can kind of see the path between where you are and where you want to be.
Amanda, does this get easier with practice?
Absolutely. And what's really interesting is that if you can build it's almost like a mindset for change. These three things sort of come together to help you believe that you can be different than you are today. So if you can change that in an area, you know, like, you know, I could be somebody who eats at home more. I'm gonna sit down and say, like, this week I'm going to cook 3 times and next week I'm going to cook 4 times. And you become a person who eats at home more, that builds your mindset about that you can be different than you are. You know, if I can make change in one area, it's a lot easier to make change in another.
Amanda, thank you for speaking with us.
My pleasure.
Amanda Kroll, educational researcher and cognitive psychologist. You can read her article for Quartz. Psychology has identified three mindsets shared by people who actually follow through on their goals. Make it your goal at wordofmouthradio.org. Well, while Americans have had their eyes glued to the performances of superstars like Katie Ledecky, Michael Phelps, and Simone Biles, across the world, millions are following a different athlete. And this story comes to us from Sandeep Roy in Kolkata, India.
On Sunday night, much of India was watching television with bated breath, all for one young woman at the Rio Olympics. Her name is Deepa Karmakar, and a billion people's hopes were resting on her shoulders. She was the first Indian woman to have qualified for gymnastics at the Olympics. And she was going to do the toughest and most dangerous maneuver of all, the front handspring and then double front somersault known as the Pradunova vault. You can break your spine doing it. It's called the death vault. It's, as the Wall Street Journal puts it, a precarious path to the medal platform. Until Deepa Karmakar, most Indians didn't know it existed. On Sunday, as she started running towards the vaulting horse, much of India forgot to breathe.
Deepa Karmakar, the first female Indian gymnast to ever qualify for the Olympic Games, the first Indian gymnast, male or female, to ever reach an Olympic event final. Fifth place on the vault at last year's World Championships.
She also does the Pradunova 7.0 difficulty, the front handspring.
This is Sandeep Roy in Kolkata. She landed, she scored 8.6, the country exhaled. But in the end, it was not enough. She lost out narrowly in the medal hunt and came in fourth. Simone Biles of the USA got another gold.
I'm just Simone Biles. Everything that has led me up to this moment has paid off and it's all been worth it. I have no regrets.
Deepa had regrets. She told NDTV that it would have hurt less if she had come fifth or sixth.
बहुत बहुत ज़्यादा दुख है मुझे. शायद मैं fifth या sixth में रहता तो मुझे इतना नहीं होता. पर fourth में मैं बहुत दुख.
Deepa Karmakar is a small town girl from northeastern India. She didn't have a proper vaulting table, just mats piled on top of each other in a gym that flooded during the monsoons. She has flat feet in her first competition. She had no shoes. She wore an oversized, ill-fitting costume. She only managed to get her Olympic berth in April. Her Pradunova vault is both a statement of her grit as it is a statement of desperation. Simone Biles came from a tough childhood, but still she does not need to do the Pradunova vault. I'm not trying to die, she told the New Yorker. Neither is Deepa Karmakar, but she does it to make up for everything else she didn't get on her way to the Olympics. Just trying the vault gets her 7 points. Deepa Karmakar defied all odds in getting to the finals. The same country that watched her with bated breath scarcely cares about investing in infrastructure and training to make anyone succeed in any sport except cricket. Athletes have sold their gold medals to make ends meet. When Duti Chand, the third Indian woman to qualify for the 100-meter sprint in Rio, was flying to Brazil, she tweeted wondering why the athletes made the grueling long journey squished into coach while the officials flew business class. She was not sure she'd have the spikes to run at Rio. What most of us watching Deepa Karmakar on television don't realize is something writer Amitava Kumar spelled out in The New Yorker. Many of the young women on the Indian team are from villages in the Indian hinterland, several of them members of the Indian Aboriginal population. Chances are they wouldn't have had the benefits of diet, training, or access to equipment that their opponents easily take for granted. The athlete soldiering on the field is from the poor, disadvantaged strata. Those disappointed, writes Kumar, are often from what used to be called the leisure class. People like me, the urban, educated middle class, pushed to get MBAs to go to institutes of engineering and management. We go abroad to make money and then lament that a country of a billion plus can't bring home a medal. We take it as a personal slight that we have to settle for fourth place. Again and again. P.T. Usha, queen of Indian track, came fourth in the 400-meter hurdles in the 1984 Los Angeles Games. In the 1960 Rome Olympics, Milkha Singh came fourth in the 400 meters. There are biopics about some of these athletes mythologizing the almost won moments. Deepa's fourth now gets added to that tally. It's being hailed as India's pride, but it is India's shame as well. Deepa fails to win a medal, said one headline. But really, Deepa didn't fail India. This 4'11" girl brought a divided nation together for a moment across all party lines. But India, in many ways, failed Deepa Karmakar. The sports minister cheered Deepa Karmakar on Twitter from Rio before she made the Pradunova vault. The tweet had his picture, not hers, and it managed to misspell her name. This is Sandeep Roy in Kolkata.
Like millions of people in India, the Word of Mouth team has been following the Olympics with some pretty unbridled enthusiasm. And we do have our favorites, of course.
My favorite Olympic event is gymnastics, for sure. The women's gymnastics. I don't really care about the guys.
Favorite event?
Yes.
Track and field. Yeah, I think I just grew up on wanting to be a track star, and I mean, it's so amazing just watching them go.
I specifically really like the relays. The medley relay, I think, is really amazing. This year, the men's medley relay, the guy who swam backstroke actually broke a world record in the medley. And I think the thing that's so great about medleys is you're finally a part of a team. When you swim, it's such an insular and individual sport. But when you're part of a team, it forces you to swim so much faster.
Well, I don't pay for cable, so I've been watching the 2012 Olympics on YouTube just to satisfy the urge. In which case, it has been very fun to go back and watch the track and field stuff.
I also like track and field. You know, I love the sprints, but I also love the 10,000 meter. It's just so much drama in this one race, and they're just absurdly fast. It's just beautiful to watch. And without fail, every time I do, I'm like, oh, I need to start training again. And then I stop training a month later.
For me, it's all about gymnastics. Nadia Comaneci got me and all my neighborhood friends hooked way back in 1976. But none of us had the skill, or apparently the mindset, to go much further than the balance beam my father built for us in the garage. Still, I have been in awe ever since. I'm Virginia Prescott, back tomorrow too with more Word of Mouth here on NHPR.
Word of Mouth is produced by Molly Donahue,
Logan Shannon,
and Jimmy Gutierrez.
Our senior producer is
Taylor Quimby,
and our executive producer is Maureen McMurray.
The views expressed in this program are those of the individuals
and not those of NHPR,
its Board of Trustees,
or its underwriters.
Word of Mouth is a production
of New Hampshire
Public Radio.